says the only beneficiary of the US assassination of General Qasem Soleimani is the Daesh terror group, which has increased its activity since then. Nancy Pelosi is narrowly re-elected as Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, with new Congress taking office amid political uncertainty. Also ahead, the UK government is under pressure to explain why some Saudi airstrikes in Yemen involving civilian casualties have been excluded from its log of humanitarian breaches. It's good to have you with us. Iran's foreign minister says the Daesh terror group has been the only beneficiary of the US assassination of General Qasem Soleimani. Mohammad Javad Zarif made the comments on his Twitter page. He said that Daesh has increased its activity since the top Iranian general was killed by the US last January. Zarif said Soleimani was the main enemy of the extremist terrorists. He said the top general was cowardly assassinated by what he called the terrorist in chief. People in several countries have marked the first anniversary of the US assassination of General Soleimani and Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis. Iraqis filled the streets of the capital Baghdad to mourn the martyrdom of the two anti-terror commanders. They called for the expulsion of US forces from Iraq. The head of the Badr organization, Hadi al-Amri, addressed the crowd. He said the Iraqi people are the rightful owners of their country, not the United States. Al-Amri also stressed the necessity to avenge the killing of Soleimani and al-Muhandis. In Yemen, people hit the streets of the northern city of Saada, demanding those behind the assassination to be brought to justice. Similar rallies also took place in other countries, including India and Canada. The Palestinian-Iranian Friendship Association has held a ceremony in the Syrian capital Damascus to pay tribute to Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated by the US in Iraq 1 year ago. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali reports.
A ceremony attended by Syrians, Palestinians, Iranians and Yemenis was held in Damascus to mark the first martyrdom anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's ambassador to Syria asserted that the resistance front will continue to fight back against any aggression, reiterating the assassination was a sign of the weakness of the United States.
By firing the missile on General Soleimani, the U.S. targeted the Iranian people, their power and pride. The U.S. wanted to thwart the resistance front's plans, but they failed. They have no choice but to leave the region.
Delegates from Syria's Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party and Yemen also delivered words on General Soleimani and his achievements in leading resistance fighters against the Western plots in the region. Vice Secretary General of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine said General Soleimani told him the only path to liberate Palestine was armed struggle and national unity between Palestinians.
And Soleimani,
General Soleimani urged us to depend on ourselves instead of others. Thanks to his efforts and advices, today we make weapons and the Palestinian resistance is currently in constant development.
Photos of General Soleimani were also exhibited, showing moments of his missions across Syria and Iraq. For years, General Soleimani led Iranian military advisors in Syria at Syria's request and played a key role in defeating Daesh terrorists as well as restoring security to hundreds of square kilometers across the Arab country. For over a week, Syrians, Iranians, and Palestinians have commemorated General Soleimani's martyrdom. And as observers say, contrary to the U.S. and its regional allies' will, General Soleimani's assassination has further strengthened unity among all members of the resistance front. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Elsewhere, Nancy Pelosi has been narrowly re-elected Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives as a new Congress took office amid the country's political uncertainty. The House voted 216 to 209 to reinstate Pelosi after Democrats lost 11 seats in the 2020 November elections to command a narrower majority. The 80-year-old lawmaker from the state of California faced a scare when a handful of fellow Democrats defected and voted present during the floor vote. Pelosi, who has led the Democratic caucus for several years, secured her fourth non-consecutive term as House Speaker. political commentator Frank Emspach says if the U.S. Republicans hold the Senate, they will spend the following years doing anything to destroy Joe Biden's administration.
I think that the danger here for the Democrats and for the centrist Democrats is this. The people, they are claiming that they lost seats because centrist Democrats lost elections and they blame the left. On the other hand, what we saw in the electoral process is that all the most progressive members of the House of Representatives won their elections. It was the more conservative members of the House that lost, and then they blamed the left. So this puts Nancy Pelosi in a tough spot. The winners have been people who are more progressive than she. That's one problem. The second problem is it's pretty clear that if the Republicans hold the Senate, and it's very, very unlikely that Democrats will win two seats in Georgia at this stage of the game, or any stage of the game. The Republicans are going to spend the next couple of years going after the Democrats, being disruptive, doing everything they can to destroy the Biden administration. And so that puts more pressure on Pelosi to find ways to unify the Democratic caucus in the House.
An audio file leaked by the Washington Post reveals that U.S. President Donald Trump has asked Georgia state officials to find him votes. We discuss the matter with our guests in the News Review program. Welcome. A leaked phone call reveals that the U.S. president has pressed the Georgia Secretary of State to overturn the 2020 presidential election results.
You know what they did, and you're not reporting it. That's a, you know, that's a criminal offense, and you know, you can't let that happen. That's a big risk to you and to Ryan, your lawyers. That's a big risk. But they are shredding ballots, in my opinion, based on what I've heard, and they are removing machinery, and they're moving it as fast as they can. Both of which are criminal fines, and you can't let it happen, and you are letting it happen. You know, I mean, I'm notifying you that you're letting it happen. So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have.
The hour-long phone conversation between Donald Trump and Brad Raffensperger was obtained by the Washington Post. In the audio, Trump reiterated his claims of voter fraud and irregularities in the U.S. state, which were repeatedly rejected by the Republican state official. His claims come as President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the state has already been certified by the Electoral College. The revelation also comes days ahead of the Congress's January 6 meeting, when Biden's victory is expected to be officially certified. Over 100 lawmakers are set to contest the certification and try to change the results in favor of Trump. Joining us on this edition of the News Review is Michael Springman, the author and former U.S. diplomat from Washington, D.C. We also have Jason Nure, political commentator from Ontario. Gentlemen, welcome. Michael, if I can start with you. I just want to find 11,780 votes. Where were these votes meant to have been found?
Well, that's a good question, because the whole process for the 2020 election was flawed from start to finish, and there are clear indications that the Democrats wanted to suppress the votes of anyone who might possibly vote for Donald Trump. It removed the Green Party from the ballot in Montana, in Texas, and Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. It worked very hard through its cast balls in the news media to paint Trump as a maniac for the past 4 years. There have been far too many reports of the issues about disappearing ballots, a trailer truckload of ballots disappearing, ballots brought in the late of night in suitcases and secretly unpacked to warrant an investigation of one kind or another. Additionally, there is the Democratic Transition Integrity Project, which was worked over last summer, in that it talked about a possible Biden win and a possible Trump win and various permutations of the two. At one point, they suggested that in the event of a Trump win, Democratic governors of several states should contest the ballots sent to Washington by the electors in that state and to field an alternative set of electors to vote for Joe Biden. They also considered the idea of several states seceding, breaking up California into several states, and having them vote for Joe Biden and so forth. It was a horrible exercise, and high officials of the Democratic Party, like John Podesta and Donna Brazile, who've been tied to Hillary Clinton, were involved in this, along with neocon commentators such as William Kristol. So I think there is plenty of argument for a biased and prejudiced election that would not make a good sham election in places like Saudi Arabia. However, the Republicans, in particular Donald Trump, have ridden off in all directions instead of coming up with real unbiased investigations that would lead to a uncovering of what really went on. They've claimed fraud without any backing for it. They've claimed bias without any backing for it. But certainly it's been pretty clear for the last 4 years that the Democrats and the mass media did not accept the results of the 2016 election.
Jason, what do you make of the Republican push to keep Trump in the White House? Do you see that as a doomed effort?
I think it's definitely an effort that's doomed to fail. But in the end, we must acknowledge what this is. This is just politics as usual, where either side is going to do whatever it is that they can in order to win because they represent different interests within the ruling elite. Now, it's really ironic that Trump would actually accuse someone else of removing machines when it was he that ordered the removal of sorting machines from post offices, had mailboxes torn out of the ground in order to undermine the ability of anyone to use mail-in voting, which would overwhelmingly be Democrats. Now, the fact is, a multitude of accusations have been brought forward about the election being stolen, none of which have borne any fruit whatsoever. There's been tremendous accusations about the Dominion voting system being linked to Venezuela, which is a complete falsehood. In fact, the Dominion voting system offices are both in Canada and the United States, and essentially doesn't have anything to do with Venezuela whatsoever. This is a president that is trying desperately to hang on to his office because he knows that once he leaves, he's probably going to be criminally prosecuted for the crimes that he has committed, which would actually be a change for once for a president to actually face justice for the crimes that they've carried out. I mean, every president is guilty of tremendous crimes, not just against the American people, but against people across the world. But I think that we are seeing the desperation of Trump in this situation. As we've seen, there's been attempted false flag inside of Iraq to blame Iran for an explosion on an Iraqi oil tanker. Many people do believe that this was a false flag attack, an attempt at a false flag attack in order to justify a war with Iran, which would then be used by Trump to suspend the transition of power and keep himself in office, most likely however long he could possibly pull it off. But I see this as just politics as usual. The Democrats would use as many underhanded attempts to get power as many as the Republican Party would use underhanded tactics in order to stay in power.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for that. Strong words there. Let's thank our guest, Michael Springman, author and former U.S. diplomat, joining us out of Washington. We also had Jason Inouye, political commentator out of Ontario. Thank you for staying tuned to this edition of The News Review. The U.S. president has once again lashed out at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, claiming the agency has exaggerated the COVID-19 pandemic in the country. Following Donald Trump's Twitter post, two top U.S. health officials disputed the claim. Infectious disease expert Anthony Fauci said the deaths, the jam-packed hospitals, and stressed-out health workers are all real, while U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams defended the CDC. Comments come as cases of the coronavirus are skyrocketing in the U.S. with daily hospitalizations marking more than a month of being over 100,000. The U.S. has reported more than 351,000 deaths out of some 20.5 million confirmed cases so far. Vaccination is also underway in the country, but the government has come under harsh criticism for the program's slow and chaotic process. While Germany and the UK plan to extend existing lockdown restrictions as coronavirus cases keep rising in both countries, German Health Minister Jens Spahn says the number of infections are still too high. He says the country must prolong its lockdown restrictions to reduce the cases. The current curbs will remain in place until January the 10th. They came into effect before Christmas. Despite that, daily cases continue to rise in Germany. On Sunday, the country reported over 10,000 new infections and more than 300 new deaths. The virus has also surged in the UK, prompting the government to consider imposing stricter measures.
It may be that we need to do things in the next few weeks that will be tougher in many parts of the country. I'm fully reconciled to that. What we're doing clearly is grappling with a new variant of the virus, which is surging particularly in London and the southeast, and that's why we've had to take exceptional measures for some parts.
The British Premier said his country will go ahead with its COVID vaccination program. On Sunday, Britain registered nearly 55,000 new cases. That's the sixth day in a row that daily infections have remained above 50,000 there. New fatalities also topped at 450. Daily infections and deaths have rapidly increased in Britain after a new COVID strain surfaced last month. Officials say the variant spreads far more quickly. Staying in Europe and in Paris, France, a protest has taken place against police violence and the global security law. Demonstrators call on the French government to forbid the controversial method of knee-on-neck choke. Our correspondent has this report.
A compact group of demonstrators took the street again in Paris to protest against police violence, and in particular against the impunity of police officers who used the very controversial method of knee-to-neck choke with fatal consequences. 1 year ago, Cédric Chouviat died after 22 seconds of knee-to-neck choke that caused him fatal wounds. He died in a hospital 2 days later. Four police officers were directly involved and indicted for involuntary homicide. The family of the victim asked for their suspension.
We have asked the Interior Minister to suspend the four police officers involved in the death and the murder of my father. We have been waiting for their suspension for 1 year now. There is no progress at all. We are waiting for a reaction, a real one.
Assa Traoré is the sister of Adama Traoré, murdered also by the knee-on-neck choke, the same method that killed George Floyd. That led to a worldwide protest asking the ban on such dangerous techniques.
That technique of immobilization used by police forces must be forbidden. That technique is fatal. We have denounced that method for 4 years now because Adam Traoré died exactly the same way as Cédric Chouviat, with a knee on his neck. Both said their last words, "I can't breathe." If French authorities had listened to us, Cédric Chouviat would not have died.
This protest is not only against police violence, but also against the global security law that would facilitate police violence, or at least would make it more difficult to film police violence. It's thanks to video footage that the beating of a music producer in Paris by police officers last November was made public.
Abnormal things are happening in this country from the police side. The government is obliged to react because there is an important mobilization, especially from the youth, against the global security law. It's important to withdraw that law.
The march ended under the Eiffel Tower, the place where Cédric Chouviat was choked to death. Cédric Chouviat died with a knee-on-neck choke. As long as this method will not be forbidden by the French government, the impunity of police officers will continue. Chris Denhant, Paris.
That report brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
With you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson, the figurehead of the Leave campaign, described Brexit as an amazing moment for the country and played up his upbeat narrative of a global Britain unshackled from rules set in Brussels. He vowed that post-Brexit Britain, despite being battered by a surge in coronavirus cases, would be an open, generous, outward-looking, internationalist and free-trading country. He said, "We have our freedom in our hands and it is up to us to make the most of it." Legally, Britain left the European Union on 31st of January, but has been in a standstill transition period during fractious talks to secure a free trade agreement with Brussels, which was finally clinched on Christmas Eve. Now the transition is over, European Union rules no longer apply. The immediate consequence is an end to the free movement of more than 500 million people between Britain and the 27 European Union states. We now present you an article written by staff writers of Agence France-Presse news agency under the heading, "Brexit Becomes Reality as UK Quits EU Single Market." Please stay with us for more. Britain finally on Thursday, 31st of December, severed its turbulent half-a-century partnership with Europe, quitting the European Union Single Market and Customs Union and going its own way, 4.5 years after its shock vote to leave the bloc. Brexit, which has dominated politics on both sides of the Channel since 2016, became a reality as Big Ben struck 11 p.m. local time, 2300 hours GMT in London, just as most of mainland Europe ushered in 2021. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson, the figurehead of the Leave campaign, described it as an amazing moment for the country and played up his upbeat narrative of a global Britain unshackled from rules set in Brussels. Boris Johnson vowed that post-Brexit Britain, despite being battered by a surge in coronavirus cases, would be an open, generous, outward-looking, internationalist and free-trading country. He said, "We have our freedom in our hands and it is up to us to make the most of it." Legally, Britain left the European Union on 31st of January, but has been in a standstill transition period during fractious talks to secure a free trade agreement with Brussels, which was finally clinched on Christmas Eve. Now the transition is over, European Union rules no longer apply. The immediate consequence is an end to the free movement of more than 500 million people between Britain and the 27 European Union member states. Customs border checks return for the first time in decades, and despite the free trade deal, queues and disruption from additional paperwork are expected. Matt Smith, managing director of HSF Logistics, which ships mainly fresh meat and chilled goods between Britain and Europe, said he was sending around 15 truckloads to the European Union on New Year's Eve, ahead of the changes. The government's new post-Brexit customs systems are largely untested, and Matt Smith was doubtful how his business would fare with the new paperwork. He told Agence France-Presse, "We're not too sure, to be honest. It seems to be a bit of a headache," he added. "There'll be delays along the line at some stage. Britain is the first member state to leave the European Union, which was set up to supposedly forge unity after the horrors of the Second World War. The 2016 referendum opened up abiding wounds between Leavers and Remainers and ushered in years of political paralysis before Boris Johnson took power last year, vowing to chart a future for Britain built on purported scientific innovation and new partnerships across the seas. A parliamentary debate on Wednesday, 30th of December, to ratify the trade deal was marked by elegiac farewells from pro-European Union lawmakers and warnings of disruption as Britain dismantles the intricate network of ties built since it joined the European Union's forerunner in 1973. While the European Union trade deal averted potential business chaos in the immediate future, the divorce will play out in many practical ways. Changes apply to everything from pet passports to how long Britons can visit their holiday homes on the continent, and an end to British involvement in a student exchange program. Potential disruption at ports is stoking fears of food and medicine shortages, as well as delays to holidaymakers and business travellers used to seamless travel within the European Union. British fishermen are disgruntled at a compromise to allow continued access for European Union boats in British waters. The key financial services sector also faces an anxious wait to learn on what basis it can keep dealing with Europe after being largely omitted from the trade agreement. In a landmark deal sealed just hours before 2300 GMT, the tiny British territory of Gibraltar will become part of Europe's passport-free zone to keep movement fluid in its border with Spain. Northern Ireland's border with the European Union member state Ireland will be closely watched to ensure movement is unrestricted, a key plank of a 1998 peace deal that ended 30 years of violence over British rule. And in pro-European Union Scotland, where Brexit has given a boost to calls for a new vote on Scottish independence, Boris Johnson faces a potential constitutional headache as 2021 dawns. But opinion polls indicate that most Britons on both sides of the referendum divide want to move on and are far more worried about the worsening coronavirus pandemic, which has hit the country harder than most. Boris Johnson, who himself was among those who were struck down by the coronavirus, warned of tough times ahead because of a resurgence of COVID-19 infections, but claimed a UK-developed vaccine offered grounds for hope. Maureen Martin from the port of Dover in Kent, that lies just across the channel from France, said, "It's going to be better." Maureen Martin added, "We need to govern ourselves and be our own bosses." The European Union has now lost 66 million people and has an economy worth $2.85 trillion. And there is regret that Britain wanted out of Europe. French President Emmanuel Macron said Britain will remain our friend and ally, but lamented that Brexit was the fruit of a lot of lies and false promises. The European Union chief negotiator Michel Barnier said, "No one has been able to show me the added value of Brexit," adding, "It's a divorce. You can't celebrate a divorce." Boarding a Eurostar train in Paris as the Brexit hour approached, François Graffin, a 59-year-old, said he was going to pack up his life in London and return to live in France. He said, "It breaks my heart." The father of British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has confirmed the plan to seek French citizenship just hours before the United Kingdom was due to leave the European Union trading rules. Stanley Johnson, Boris Johnson's father, told a French radio show on Thursday, 31st of December, that he's applying for French citizenship because his mother was born in France. He said, "It's not about becoming French, it's about reclaiming what I already have." Stanley Johnson added, "I will always be European. Having a tie with the European Union is important." If his citizenship application is accepted, Johnson will acquire a passport of an EU member country, with the advantage of free travel across the bloc as free movement of Britons in the European Union comes to an end. The 80-year-old former Conservative member of the European Parliament voted to remain in the 2016 Brexit referendum. In Britain, Brexit has been the culmination of years of anti-Brussels agitation, as the European Union morphed from a trading community to a more ambitious political project. However, the 2016 referendum never spelt out what shape Brexit should take. Boris Johnson's predecessor, Theresa May, repeatedly failed to drive through a soft separation that would have kept Britain largely bound to the European Union. But he drove a much harder bargain, to the profound unease of UK businesses and opposition political parties. Now, after months of stormy negotiations that were repeatedly upended by the pandemic, Brussels too is keen to move on. But UK lawmaker Chris Hazard from the Irish Republican Sinn Féin Party said Brexit was far from over. Chris Hazard warned, "When all the bluster dies down, it will become depressingly clear that this trade deal is the beginning of a new trading relationship built on permanent negotiation, disputes and recriminations." The Daily Telegraph, where Boris Johnson made his name as Brussels-bashing Europe correspondent, said the government faced a new reality shorn of the EU bogeyman. It said, "Politicians will have to get used to bearing much greater responsibilities than they have been used to whilst the UK has been within the European Union."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise their children Islamically. The main source is the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And we have in our studio guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the program, Sister Salma.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. So in our previous episode, we were talking about common mistakes that parents make when bringing up their child. And we have been talking about the mistakes. And the last mistake we talked about was lack of family time and communication, which is something very crucial and unfortunately, you know, is not given so much attention to. So please tell us more.
One of the other mistakes that I'd like to mention is that Islamic home setting should be there. Mm-hmm. Parents lose out on that sometimes. They feel that children will learn Islam anyway, especially if they're living in countries that have Islamic schools. Even if they're Western countries, some do send their children to Islamic schools, right? Or Islamic countries, they feel that there's no need to. So, you know, like, not much emphasis is laid in our day-to-day lifestyles to act Islamically. First of all, when we start talking also, we don't involve Allah and the Ahlul Bayt in our talks.
Yeah.
That's the main thing that makes children feel that there's all material and money and wealth and things that are supposed to be attended to in life. Material aspect is given much importance. What did you wear? What new clothes am I supposed to get? Or what new books? Or what toys do I need? Or what games am I playing? Or who is coming? Or what food have you made?
Yeah.
All these things are material aspects, right? Mm-hmm. Have we involved Allah and Ahlul Bayt in our talks daily? That's very important for Islamic home setting, for children to know. And I've noticed that in the West also, when there were no Western schools and people went to settle there, when they started getting concerned about the children's future,
yeah,
they started doing more of these activities, you know, Islamic activities at home. Such children turned out to be very great. And they are now leaders of their own communities.
Mm, very true.
Because they had this Islam in their home, the home setting environment. Even if the outside world is not like that, the home setting is the first social arena to inculcate these kind of good habits, the Islamic habits. So talk about Allah and Ahlul Bayt more, get them involved more, you know, like azadari and, for example, a happy occasion, for example, birthday of our imams, our infallible leaders, things like that should be actually, you know, zoomed.
Exactly.
That today is, for example, the birthday of Hazrat Zainab, salamullahi alayha.
Yeah,
it's
we
a
can
very
do like
happy
a
occasion.
Party or, you know, hold a session, go, especially like in
make
this
a cake
of, yeah,
make them feel that this is part of our life, these personalities are part of our lives, right?
And I think in this, especially in this time of corona, I think the families have started to miss out. They feel like they miss these kind of programs because they bring so much togetherness. This remembrance of these kind of infallibles is so important. It's like it brings you, it awakens you. I also used to feel like when I'd come to Iran and I used to see in these, like when Nowruz, the new year of the calendar, the Iranian calendar, I would see that most of the Iranians would go to the harams or to the imamzades, the grandchildren of the imams. And it was so surprising because I would feel like it's like they want to celebrate their start of their year with, you know, the imams. And the,
yeah,
it's something so beautiful. It's like, as Muslims, it naturally comes, it's from us, it's within us. We want to, you know, have this kind of an appreciation to them and all.
Yeah. And it starts with the Islamic setup at home.
Yeah, exactly.
If that is not done, and the movies are given importance to what you watched, what cinema you, what you wore, where you went, what parks or restaurants did you go, the child will, his head will revolve around those kind of things as his main, you know, like duties or maybe main pastimes.
Exactly.
Instead of looking at the actual beauty of life, and that is to involve Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and Ahlul Bayt in your day-to-day activities, in everything that you do.
Thank you very much. We're just going to take a short break, and after the break, we're going to continue this discussion. Please stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
So you're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. You were talking about how it is important for families to keep an Islamic home setting, you know, at home.
Yeah, and this involves also the sometimes parents make this mistake of lack of monitoring their children.
Yeah.
And then what happens is that they choose their own things to play, and instead of us watching them over of what they're playing, and then they choose the wrong things to watch also sometimes, you know. We feel it's just a harmless cartoon, but this cartoon may have wrong messages.
Exactly.
So we have to oversee all these things before we even start giving them, in doses even. Like, for example, we feel now it's time for watching cartoon, maybe screen time, maybe 30 minutes or 1 hour, whatever. Well, we feel whatever he watches, it's okay. Islamic environment, like in the Islamic Republic of Iran, it might be minimized, this kind of consequences, bad consequences. But what about the outside world?
Yeah.
What about in the West? We see that a unicorn even has a meaning.
Exactly.
It's just like threatening to a child. You know, like unicorns, wearing t-shirts of unicorns are in fashion. Wow. What is behind that? Wrong messages portrayed.
Yeah, the subliminary messages.
Exactly. And that's really something that you don't monitor about the child. So you have to really monitor. A lack of monitoring would spoil that Islamic home setting. So parents should not make this mistake of not monitoring their children.
Because right now when parents, they are tired or they feel like they want to have alone time or something like that, they'll say, now, you know, lucky, you can keep the iPad now. You can do whatever you want. So I guess also this kind of, because we are, unfortunately, we tend to get lazy fast or you get tired fast, we tend to leave the child now to do what they want. So I feel like this happens a lot, unfortunately, especially in our communities where they want to have their free time. They want to have... There has to be, now that you have a child, you have to commit yourself and do your job, you know, in the best way possible.
You have to commit. In fact, I find it more tedious to give something like this to my child because now I have to watch over.
Yeah.
But if an activity is given, like a coloring or things like that, and, you know, like you oversee to that, even if I'm resting... Every 5 minutes, I'll call out and see what is she doing and probably go to have a peek at her. And that's good. From a young age, she knows she's being watched. It feels even good to her, to a child, you know, that I'm given that support. And you shouldn't even make it so like a policeman kind of thing. You should say it in a very beautiful way, a subtle way that, you know, like you're not alone.
Yeah.
I'd love to see what you did.
It's like that's going to make us remember that as when we finish this period, that Allah is always watching us.
So yeah, that's right.
Will always make us remember that, you know, there is somebody watching us.
Yeah, that's a very good thing you mentioned, that we come to know, a child comes to know later on that my mom was always watching me, and now look, alhamdulillah, I've come what I've come to be, and I'm trying to even, you know, I've not got into any bad habits because of that, because of respecting and fearing her, and now I fear Allah because He's watching me all the more from all sides, right?
Exactly.
So, and another thing is that, you know, usually when a boy or a girl comes to their teenage years and they start becoming more independent, they might do something privately that we don't even know of. Even if they appear to be so good outwardly, but because of lack of monitoring, you know, parents come to find out that, you know, some kind of evil habit in the children. For example, what he watches.
Yeah.
Na'udhubillah, if he watches the pornography. And then the parents come to find out how much it breaks the heart of the parents, right?
Mm.
And these are some mistakes that do happen because of not being taken seriously of monitoring the children. Even if they've reached their teens, to do it in a very subtle way, like take for them something to eat, even if they've closed their rooms. In fact, not giving them all that freedom to surf the internet.
Exactly.
Right?
That's very true. So we're just going to take a short break, and inshallah we'll continue this discussion after the break.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, excessive blame causes the fire of obstinacy to flame.
Alright, so you're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. So we have been talking about how we have to instill this kind of an Islamic home setting, and how it is important for us to be, you know, careful on what our children do. We have to try and monitor our children more, because they should always know that, you know, their parents are there and they're watching them, but not in a way that they should feel scared all the time.
Or interfered.
Yeah, right? Or interfered with. Yeah. So, yes.
Usually this phase comes about, you know, when they're feeling that they're interfered with, is when you leave them alone completely in their young age. Then when they grow up, they feel now, you know, now is the time that the parents feel threatened that maybe he'll do something or she'll do something privately now that she's grown up, you know, and they're facing their own challenges as they grow up. So let me see what they're doing. That's the time that feel interfered. But if you're watching them from a young age, they know that you're supporting them, with them, you're friends with them, you know, in a very respectable manner. So they wouldn't dare to do that, and they wouldn't need to do that also. Yeah. But because they wouldn't have a lack in their hearts, or gap of a lack of attention in their hearts. They'll get all the attention in the young age, so they'd see no reason to do it.
Yeah.
And of course, you talk over such things, the such challenges that they face in school and from the outsider, whatever, the peers and things like that. So you talk over these things, and very smartly you explain them, and you tell them what are the disadvantage of certain behaviors that would ruin their lives.
Exactly.
You know,
and also I feel like from a young age, they shouldn't feel like they're always scared of you. We have to try and make them understand through our actions that, you know, what is really the right thing and what is not. Because so that when later on, they shouldn't feel like we have to do something because our parents are here.
Yeah.
It has to be done like naturally. They should want to do it because it's a good thing. This whole process of bringing up your child should be in such a way that the child will themselves feel like, this is what is important, this is what is wrong for me to do, and I want to, you know, grow up as a healthy person. So what you instill into their minds, everything plays a part.
And the best, as I mentioned, is monitoring, but with love and precaution and in subtlety.
Yeah.
So that as they grow up, then they don't feel that you're interfering with them. They feel that this is the support that our parents are showing. And parents would notice that they don't have to put a video camera in their rooms or something.
Yeah.
But they would just notice that how the children behave and how they use their free time. And they would also feel, you know, relaxed that certain times can be given, like, of privacy to my child, because they would know for certain.
And to show them maybe you trust them, and you know that they won't be...
But it comes after an age of monitoring a lot, you know. Because certain ages are so, like, sensitive that you have to be with them and you have to train them and you have to occupy them such that they don't get deviated in their thoughts.
Exactly.
Shaitan is an open enemy after all.
Yeah, definitely. Inshallah, thank you very much. And inshallah that we will be able to, you know, try and read and learn more how we can, you know, administer these things in the right way.
Inshallah.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. So, dear audience, thank you for joining us on the program. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Inshallah, until the next program, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The article you're about to hear has been written by Carolyn Gramlin. Carolyn Gramlin is a writer on earth, environment, and climate. The piece is titled Wildfires, Heat Waves and Hurricanes Broke All Kinds of Records in 2020. Stay with us for more of Carolyn Gremlin's article. was a year of unremitting extreme climate events, from heat waves to wildfires to hurricanes, many of which scientists have directly linked to human-caused climate change. Each event has taken a huge toll in terms of lives lost and damage incurred. As of early October, the United States alone had weathered at least 16 climate or weather-related disasters, each costing more than $1 billion. The price tags of the late-season hurricanes Delta, Zeta, and Eta could push the final 2020 tally of such expensive disasters even higher, setting a new record. With the COVID-19 pandemic dominating the news, some of these events may have already faded into memory. And now we take a look at this year of climate extremes. The bushfires that burned southeastern Australia between July of 2019 and March of 2020 scorched roughly 11 million hectares of land and killed dozens of people. Climate change made those devastating fires at least 30% more likely to occur. The primary reason, a prolonged and severe heat wave that baked the country in 2019 and 2020. Which itself was exacerbated by climate change. The intensity of Australia's wildfires produced some striking sights. A particularly intense wildfire led to the formation of towering pyrocumulonimbus clouds that launched hundreds of thousands of metric tons of smoke into the stratosphere. One massive plume of smoke, wrapped in rotating winds, ascended to a record 31 kilometers in the atmosphere, deep into the Earth's protective ozone layer. Although it's not clear what chemical scars is left, such a large smoke plume has the potential to trigger chemical reactions that destroy the ozone layer. Record-setting wildfires in western United States also produce images of raging blazes, orange skies, destroyed homes, neighborhoods enveloped in acrid smoke. By mid-November, more than 9,200 wildfires in California had burnt about 1.7 million hectares of land, more than double the acreage burnt in 2018, the state's previous record fire year. Meanwhile, Colorado battled three of the largest wildfires in the state's history. Combined, those fires burnt more than 219,000 hectares of land. The role of climate change in these blazes is multi-pronged. From California to Colorado, rising temperatures due to climate change have led to earlier spring snow melting, resulting in drier vegetation by summer. In California, that extremely dry vegetation combined with a record-breaking heat wave primed the landscape for runaway wildfires. Climate change is increasing the frequency of extreme climate conditions. California's average heat and dryness in both summer and autumn have become more severe, dramatically increasing the number of days each year prone to extreme fire weather conditions. Simulations of future climate change project increasing dryness over at least the next few decades, which means 2020's fire records aren't likely to stand for long. In the meantime, for January through to July, Siberia was in the grips of a powerful heat wave that led to record-breaking temperatures and thawing permafrost. Such a heat wave in Siberia, with temperatures as high as 38 degrees Celsius, about 100 degrees Fahrenheit, would have been impossible without climate change. human influence made the heat wave at least 600 times as likely, and possibly as much as 99,000 times as likely, according to scientific reports. Moreover, the carbon dioxide churned into the atmosphere by this year's Arctic wildfires also smashed the previous record for the region, set in 2019. That carbon dioxide can beget further warming, and the fires can also speed up permafrost thaw, which could add more of another greenhouse gas, methane, to the atmosphere. This year also saw the second lowest extent of Arctic sea ice on record. Meanwhile, a roughly Manhattan-sized chunk of Canada's Mion ice shelf, close to half of what had been the country's last intact ice shelf, suddenly collapsed into the Arctic Ocean in August of this year, carrying an ice observing station away with it. As early as April of this year, scientists predicted that the Atlantic hurricane season, which lasts from 1st of June through to 30th of November, would be busy, with about 18 named storms, compared with an average of 12 each year. By August, scientists upped their predictions to as many as 25, but 2020 surpassed even those expectations. By mid-November, there were 30 named storms, eclipsing a record set back in 2005. It's difficult to link climate change to the number of storms that form in a given year. Very warm ocean waters, such as in the Atlantic Ocean this year, foster tropical cyclone formation. It's true that those warm waters are linked to climate change, as the surface ocean swallows up excess heat from the atmosphere. But other factors are also involved in hurricane formation, including wind conditions, making it difficult to establish a definite link. But there are established links between warming oceans and increasing hurricane intensity, as well as rainfall. Warm Atlantic Ocean waters gave a boost to the intense storms of the 2017 hurricane season, for example. The warm waters can also provide enough energy to give hurricanes extra staying power even after landfall. And as the world saw in 2020, very warm ocean waters can also speed up how quickly a storm strengthens, leading to dangerous, difficult to predict, suddenly supercharged storms. Such rapid intensification is defined as sustained wind speeds increasing by at least 55 kilometers per hour within just 24 hours. 2020 saw that in abundance, with 10 Atlantic storms rapidly intensifying in the region's bath-like waters before making landfall.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.